President Donald Trump is dominating international headlines, but domination has consequences. Thanks for listening to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. It is Tuesday, January 13. United States forces captured the president of Venezuela and brought him to New York for prosecution. And President Donald Trump said at the time that the U.S. would now run the country. Trump is also threatening strong military action in Iran. That government declares protesters, quote, enemies of God, and punishes demonstrators with death. President Trump also continues to signal his intentions to take over Greenland. So I welcomed Professor Tim Shorn to the SDPB studios to help sort through what all of this means for us and for America. We begin here with Iran.
Well, I think the first thing we need to understand is that any time a foreign country intervenes in the domestic politics of another country, it rarely goes as planned. That there are unknowns that we would not be prepared to address. We also know that even if a government is unpopular, if an outside country intervenes in the domestic politics or invades, that there's usually a rally around the flag effect. So if we want to make the current government of Iran more popular, then we should certainly intercede militarily on behalf of the protesters, because that's going to be the result. It's always, you know, we would prefer our own SOB over a foreign SOB. And the United States does not have a good track record of establishing democracies, of creating stability after we intervene in Middle Eastern countries and elsewhere.
What about the tens of thousands of protesters who might be saying, America, we need you, here we are?
And they may very well feel that way. It's possible that they are just the tip of the iceberg of those who want to overthrow the government of Iran. And I expect that that is the case. But rarely does someone want to give up their own national sovereignty and hand it over to a country that intervenes or invades, because the question always becomes, when is that intervener or invader going to leave? What are they going to do in the meantime? Who are they going to put in power? What kind of control are they going to exercise? And the United States has a pretty poor track record of creating stability, of handing power over to the people, of creating a better economy for the common person. And so I think Iranians are not unfamiliar with our record with interventions. In fact, the last time we intervened in Iran in the 1950s, we removed a democratically elected prime minister and elevated the role of the Shah to absolute dictator. That might not be in the front of the mind of the protesters, but it's certainly in the back of the mind of a lot of people in Iran.
So what are the president's options right now?
Right now, I would suggest that the president just hold back. I mean, he has various options. One is to do nothing. One is to give verbal, vocal, political, diplomatic support to the protesters. A third option would be to try to get people in on the ground to maybe assist the protesters, to look for ways to encourage the current regime to move on or at least to liberalize. And the fourth would be to invade. The third option is unlikely because Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader, is not going to voluntarily give up the power of the Ayatollahs. And the president and the head of the military and the secret police know which side of the bread their butter is on. They are not going to turn on Ayatollah Khamenei and his supporters. So I don't see that the third option is particularly appealing either, which takes us back to the second option, and that is to speak clearly and forcefully, though diplomatically, in favor of the protesters and liberalization of the Iranian regime. But given the track record of the Trump administration, I don't expect that to happen either. And it's clear that option number one, the do nothing, is not really on the table. Mm. The question becomes, which option does the administration choose and how much damage is done in the process?
Do the strikes in Iran previously, recently in the Trump administration play into what's happening in the destabilization of Iran right now at all?
I doubt it. Most of the protests in Iran have been simmering. The discontentment in Iran has been simmering. It comes and goes, and it goes really depending on how brutal the government crackdown is. Mm. And we can expect that if we start carrying out any types of strikes against the Iranian government and military, that, in fact, the crackdown will be extremely brutal. And the Iranian government will be able to essentially paint the protesters as agents of the United States, and that will delegitimate them in the minds of other Iranians. You know, again, that rally around the flag, that natural kind of patriotism when you become under attack, would come into play after that as well.
What happens in the region if the Iranian economy goes into full collapse? They're already, I guess, depending on what you call it, collapse. But if this economic situation continues to worsen, how does that impact the region?
What we would probably see is the attempt of some Iranians to flee the country. The problem for the Iranian people is that there are no good choices around them. There's no place that they would really want to flee to. The only thing that we would expect over the long term is that any of the neighboring countries are simply transit points, and where they're going to try to get to would be Europe, maybe some of the more stable Middle Eastern countries. What it would mean is simply an increasing humanitarian cost when it comes to, you know, fuel during the winter, food, medical care. But as far as it causing a major ripple effect in the rest of the region, probably not.
I want to pivot momentarily to Venezuela and talk about what's happening next there, because we're hearing reports, as you and I are recording this conversation, about political prisoners being released, which President Trump says is an excellent thing, and then also reports that not very many political prisoners are being released. We're in the stage where, after the president gave his press conference saying we were going to run Venezuela, are we running it now? Like, where are we at in the transition, and what do you anticipate happens next?
That's a good question, and I would argue that almost no one knows, including the Trump administration. The problem that we are confronting is that the person that is in charge, the Venezuelan in charge of Venezuela right now, was Maduro's vice president. This is not a small D Democrat. This is not somebody who is going to liberalize the political situation. This, my guess, in the mind of the Trump administration, is a more pliable strongman, that this is somebody that we can control to some extent in order to attempt to get what we want. So there's not going to be any changes in Venezuela in this case. If there are prisoners being released, and there are, it's probably window dressing. It's probably those who are least likely to cause problems for the current regime. And the question has to be asked, are these really political prisoners, or are these common criminals being released wearing the cloak of political prisoner in order to appease the Trump administration? Now, clearly, one of the things that the Trump administration wants is American control over Venezuelan oil, but there's a significant misunderstanding about Venezuelan oil. Countries self-report known reserves. And so if the Saudis want to increase their stand in OPEC, they say, oh, we have more reserves than originally reported. In the case of Venezuela, once Maduro took over, he tripled the amount of known reserves that the government of Venezuela reported, which then makes Venezuela a more appealing partner for those who are looking for oil. It gives them greater standing within OPEC, but it's unlikely they actually have the reserves that they are reporting. Yeah. Second, what is it going to cost to extract the oil that they do have and to essentially exploit the oil reserves that are there? And is there any American company that is even remotely interested in doing that? On the face of it, it appears that there aren't a lot of American oil companies who are interested in heading to Venezuela because the cost of exploiting that oil is going to be an incredibly long-term process. And eventually, American attention and interest of Venezuela will wane, and we look at the probability of Venezuela naturalizing their oil resources again. And then the American companies that went down there are left holding a debt and investment that they're not going to be able to repay based on Venezuelan oil. So I think what we should be looking forward to in Venezuela is great disappointment and a very underwhelming long-term effect of our removal of Maduro.
What about this other angle, which was that the narco-terrorism efforts, and I sent you an email earlier this week asking about what exactly does that word mean? Is that an international definition? Right. When we're saying narco-terrorism, is that what? And help us understand the role of drugs in this.
And that's, I mean, to be honest, in the case of Venezuela, they are no better, no worse than any other drug trafficking country. This was, I would argue, a smokescreen. Now, when we start invoking the term narco-terrorism, this goes back to the early to mid-1990s. A lot of the opposition groups, the military, paramilitary forces, the guerrilla groups that were all opposed to the governments in Latin America were left-of-center groups. And a lot of them were supported by Soviet money, Soviet weapons, Soviet training. With the collapse of the Soviet Union, that money stream, that training stream stopped. Consequently, these groups who were opposed to the governments of El Salvador, Nicaragua, Colombia, and elsewhere had to look for money elsewhere. Where was the money? You know, especially as we saw the 90s and into this century, it was in drugs. And so some of them sold their souls to the drug traffickers. They became maybe the security. Maybe they became the people who had a better chance of trafficking the drugs, getting them out of the country. And so what we started to see was a coming together of those left-of-center groups we had always considered to be terrorist groups and the traffickers. The resulting term was narco-terrorism. Now, for the most part, those narco-terrorists, they did not share goals. The political groups still wanted to overthrow the government, although eventually they had been seduced by the money and decided money was better. The drug traffickers didn't care about the politics. They just wanted to get their merchandise out. And so they worked together. There really is no such thing as narco-terrorism. I mean, I guess we can look at it. In some cases, Mexico comes to mind, where there are occasional assassinations of political candidates, political leaders, law enforcement officials, judges, who are trying to tackle the cartels, and the cartels decide, let's just remove them and put somebody else in that position who's more obedient. So narco-terrorism is a sexy term that probably confuses the issue. And what we really need to think about is, what do the cartels need to do to get their product out? Are their governments playing a role? And how do we distinguish between the two if they are separate?
Has this been an innovative way by the Trump administration to fight the criminal drug activity and drugs that are coming into the United States in various ways?
No. It allows for some great TV moments, but more often than not, what we are doing is violating international law and probably violating our own law as well. We are not allowed to carry out military strikes against civilian boats, even if they are engaged in drug trade. We have other laws that deal with that, and that's criminal law. This is simply a short run around the law around the difficulty of fighting drug trafficking, and then wrapping it up with the bow of, oh, look, there's Maduro. He's a dictator. He's a drug trafficker. Let's legitimate what we're doing by saying we're going after Maduro. If we were truly interested in going after drug trafficking, we would be spending more money on addressing the issue here. We wouldn't be pardoning people who were in prison for drug trafficking. This is simply a way for the Trump administration to look like it's doing something meaningful, but the long-term consequences are not going to be what they had hoped.
Let's talk about Greenland, because this is something else that the president, President Donald Trump, has said. We may need to essentially take Greenland, and military force is not off the table. This seems unprecedented to me.
It probably is, at least in...
From an American president.
Yeah.
I mean...
And the modern era. I mean, granted, with the Spanish-American War, we were able to grab Cuba, Puerto Rico, the Philippines, and elsewhere, but...
America grabbed the Black Hills.
I'm not
naive about history, but what I'm saying is in the modern era, a modern president saying, and now we're going to take this territory, seems like a significant...
Yeah.
Headline.
We had hoped that that had stopped, you know, over a century ago. And this is, one, it's absurd. Two, it's frightening. One, it is absurd because there is no reason to take Greenland, that if we're concerned about precious metals and strategic minerals, there are ways to negotiate deals where we are able to extract them and use them for our purposes or to purchase them. It is frightening because this will do incredible damage, and it is already doing incredible damage to our relations with Europe and probably all democracies, because they're not going, there's no one who is a liberal democracy who is going to be able to support us if we take this step. And it will sever the relations with Western and Central Europe. It will legitimate what Putin does, what China would do. This would be a horrible move and a horrible precedent, and would end the international system that we had worked so hard to build, beginning in World War II and through the 20th century.
For people who say, Dr. Shorin, American military might is back. This is a notice to the international community that we are not afraid to take bold military action, especially in our hemisphere, that President Donald Trump is just doing the thing that other presidents have been afraid to do. This is a step forward for us. What would your response to be? And by this, I mean the intersection of all these international actions compiled with what President Trump sees as his record toward peace. What would your response to be to average South Dakotan who is looking at all this and feeling like, yeah, this we should be dominant in this way? What would you respond?
I would say, what does American stand for? Are we a democracy? Are we encouraging democracy? Do we believe in human rights? Do we believe in the rule of law? Do we believe in the equality of countries? If the answer is yes, then what we are doing needs to stop. If the answer is no, then we can bury the notion of American exceptionalism and say that, well, essentially, we're like any other strong country. We do what we want. We don't abide by rules. We're better than everyone else. We don't care about anyone else. Everything that, you know, we, you know, started creating going back to the 1770s is false. And so is that what the founding generation wanted? No. I mean, that was fairly clear at the time. What we also need to consider then is if we're using military forces, it's going to be South Dakotans, the sons and daughters, brothers and sisters, mothers and fathers, nieces and nephews of South Dakotans and others who go out and pay that price while people in high positions protect their family members from having to get their hands dirty or, dare I say, bloody. And so I think we need to decide, what does America stand for and what role do we want to play in that?
What is the influence of U.S. Senator John Thune from South Dakota right now in this conversation?
I don't see him attempting to influence the conversation at all, certainly not publicly. And this notion of somebody trying to influence the conversation privately, I simply don't buy anymore, because perception matters. And if you're going to stand for something, you need to stand for it publicly. And I don't see Senator Thune doing anything to slow what President Trump wants to do. And I would argue, if anything, Senator Thune has essentially allowed Congress to play second fiddle to President Trump's conducting. And so I don't see Senator Thune having an especially large role in this, except as a water carrier for the current administration.
When you have students in your classroom, students who are interested in international relations, what kinds of questions do you encourage them to ask of their government when they read the headlines and see what's happening? What kind of conversations do we have with each other that make a difference in how we are seen in the world?
The first question I always tell my students to ask is, why? Why are we intervening in Venezuela? Well, we want to remove Maduro, or we want to stop the drug trafficking, or we want to gain control over oil. So the next question is, why? Well, and you keep asking why until you get to the root of the issue. And through the process of asking why, you're going to find out what the real reason for doing something or not doing something is, which may be the stated reason, but oftentimes is not. And I think that in any conversation, if there is anything less than three whys, we're not getting very far. And we're simply accepting somebody else's narrative without understanding the background, the context, the hidden agenda, the ultimate goal.
Any final thoughts?
It's going to be an interesting ride through spring. I think all of the issues that we've talked about are going to remain front and center. Mm-hmm. The question becomes, what issues will surprise us? And, you know, kind of what can of worms will each of the steps we take open in the future? Nothing America does happens in a vacuum. The idea of, you know, us sneezing and the world catching a cold is very much true. What will our interventions in Venezuela or possibly Iran or possibly in Greenland, what effects will those have in Asia, in Africa, in the larger Middle East? And I would suggest that none of the effects, none of the ramifications are going to be remotely positive. And so I think we need to watch very carefully. And this is why powerful, independent three branches of government are so important.
Dr. Tim Shorn, thank you so much for the insight. As always, it's a pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
Professor Tim Shorn leads the International Studies Program at the University of South Dakota. We sat down together in our SDPB studios in Sioux Falls. That is our conversation for today. I hope that it served you. If you are enjoying the In the Moment podcast, like, rate, download, share, tell a friend, all those things, and send me an email, inthemoment@sdpb.org. I'm Lori Walsh. Talk to you tomorrow. And as always, thank you for listening.